Discourse number 11.
Bhagwan, Zhao Xiangzu went hunting in the central mountains with a party of 100,000. He set fire to the forests by lighting the tall grass and fanned the flames for 100 miles. A man came out from within a stone cliff, rising and falling with the smoke and ashes. The crowd thought he was a demon. When the fire passed, he came out walking casually as though the fire he had passed through did not exist. Zhao Xiangzu marveled and detained the man. He scrutinized him at leisure. In his shape, his color, and the 7 holes in his head, he was human. In his breathing, in his voice, he was human. He asked the man by what way he lived in stone and went through fire. "What are these things you call stone and fire?" said the man. "The thing you have just come out from was stone. The thing you have just been walking through was fire." "I didn't know," said the man. Marquis Wen of Wei heard of it and questioned Su Tsai. "What sort of man was that?" "According to what I have heard my master say, the man who is in harmony is absolutely the same as other things, and no thing succeeds in wounding him or obstructing him. To pass through metal and stone and to tread through water and fire are all possible." "Why don't you do it yourself?" said the Marquis Wen. "I am not yet capable of cutting open my heart and throwing away the knowledge in it. However, I can tell you all you want to know about it." "Why doesn't your master do it?" asked the Marquis Wen. "My master is one who, though able to do it, is able not to do it." Marquis Wen was delighted with the answer.
There is a very significant distinction to be made in the very beginning. The distinction between knowledge and knowing. Knowledge only appears to know. It knows not. Knowing may not appear to know, but it knows. Knowledge is borrowed. Knowing is one's own. Knowledge is verbal. Knowing is through living. Knowledge is information gathered from here and there. Knowing is existential. You have lived it. It has come through your very experience. It is an experience. When knowing happens, a man is freed. He is liberated. Through knowledge, man becomes more of a prisoner. Knowledge binds, knowing liberates. And the paradox is that the man of knowledge claims that he knows, and the man of knowing does not even know that he knows. The man of knowing is innocent. There is a very famous mystic treatise in the West, the only one in the West. Nobody knows who wrote it. Nobody knows from whom it came, but it must have come from a tremendous experience. The name of the treatise is The Cloud of Unknowing. It is from a man of knowing. But he calls it the cloud of unknowing. He says, when I came to know, I forgot all knowledge. All knowledge disappears. There is no need for knowledge when you know. When you don't know, you cling to knowledge. Because only through that knowledge you can pretend to know. When you know, you can forget knowledge. When you don't know, how you can afford to forget it? So only the greatest knowers have been able to forget knowledge. That is the peak, and it has to be remembered. Here living with me, here being with me, don't become man of knowledge. Otherwise you would have missed me. Become man of knowing. Become clouds of unknowing. Which is the same thing in other words. Knowing is almost like unknowing. Because in knowing there is no knower. The ego does not exist. In knowledge there is a division. The division of the known and the knower. The division of the subject and the object. In knowing there is no division. Knowing is not divisive. It is unitive. It unites. Science is a sort of knowledge. Religion, a sort of knowing or unknowing. Hence their paths never cross anywhere. And they will never cross. Where science ends, religion begins. Where cunningness ends, innocence begins. Where the knower disappears, knowing comes in. In the biblical story of Adam's expulsion, there is something to be understood in this context. That story is so beautiful, I come to it again and again. With different meanings, with different interpretations. God said to Adam, you can enjoy all the fruits of this garden, but there are two trees. One is called the tree of life, another is called the tree of knowledge. Please never eat from the tree of knowledge. He mentions two trees, the tree of life and tree of knowledge. He says nothing about the tree of life. He simply says, don't eat from the tree of knowledge. But Adam was too much curious. Hence the servant could persuade him. Otherwise the servant would not have been persuasive, would not have succeeded. Adam must have deep down curious about it, as every child is, and Adam was the first child. And God was the first father. He is persuaded to eat from the tree of knowledge. He ate and he became a knower. Immediately he felt ashamed. Immediately he felt he is naked. Up to now he was innocent. The innocence was primordial, absolute, unconditional. He was not aware that he was naked. In fact, he was not aware that he was. The ego enters. From the fruit of the tree of knowledge, ego is created. He becomes alert. He starts judging whether I am beautiful or not, whether it is to be good to be naked or not. He becomes aware of his body. for the first time he becomes self-conscious. Up to now, he was not self-conscious. Not that he was not conscious. He was conscious, but there was no self in it. The consciousness was pure, unobstructed. The consciousness was just a pure light. But suddenly, the ego stands like a pillar in the middle of consciousness, a dark pillar, a pillar of darkness. And the story says he was expelled. In fact, God need not expel him. He has expelled himself through eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge. Knowledge is expulsion. The moment you become aware of your ego, you are expelled from the beauty, from the benediction, from the delight, from joy that life has to offer to you. Now, what happened to the other tree? The tree of life. Nothing is said about it. My own interpretation is, had Adam eaten first from the tree of life and then from the tree of knowledge, there would have been no expulsion. If knowledge had come through living, if knowledge had come through experience, there would have been no expulsion. This knowledge was bogus. It had not come through one's own experience. It was unearned. It was immature. Hence the expulsion. It was borrowed. It was not his own. When it comes through experience, it liberates. It makes you more joyous. It makes you more delighted in existence. If Adam had eaten first the fruit of the tree of life and then the fruit of the tree of knowledge, there would have been no expulsion. He reversed the process. He ate from the tree of knowledge. And once you eat from the tree of knowledge, you start losing life. You cannot eat from the tree of life then. So the expulsion is self-imposed. Remember it. Knowledge can come in two ways. You can have it from others, from books, from people, from the society, and you can claim it is your. But then you are expelled. Remember, and the expulsion is self-imposed. Nobody is expelling you. Your very wrong approach towards knowing becomes a barrier. But knowledge can be attained through another way, that is through experience, through life. Eat the fruit of the tree of life first, and the knowledge comes silently, without even any whisper. It arises in your soul. Because if you go into experience, the ego is not created. The more you experience life, the less you have the self. Once life is known its totality, you don't think yourself as separate from existence. You have fallen in the unity. You have become one. You have become one with the whole. You are part of the organic unity of existence. And then there is a knowing, a totally different kind of knowing which liberates. Eat the fruit of the tree of life. There is another parable in the Bible that when God created the world, he asked Adam to name things. he will bring the lion and he will ask Adam, what name do you give to this animal? He will bring the elephant and he will ask, what name you give to this animal? And Adam named all things. And since then, man has been doing the same. All your knowledge is nothing but labeling, naming. If you ask somebody, do you know this flower? And he says, yes, I know it is a rose. What he knows? Just the name. What else do you know? By knowing the name rose, do you know the rose? By name the word God, do you know God? By knowing the name love, do you know love? That parable is also beautiful. Adam was foolish enough. He should have said, no, how I can name? I don't know these things. But he named the elephant, the rose, the lion, the tiger. And since then, that's what man has been doing continuously down the ages. Just naming things. If you know the name of the person, you think you know the person. So when you introduce people to each other, you just tell them their name. Or their country. Their race. But what are you doing? Is the person known that way? The person is so vast. So huge. How can you label and know by the label? But naming gives a false impression as if you know. A couple whose new home was completed very recently had hardly moved in before the neighbors came over to inspect it. Naturally, the conversation was on the subject of the new house. It is very nice, commented one visitor. But I don't see why you call this type of house a bungalow. Well, explained the owner, we just don't know what else to call it. The job was a bungalow and we still owe for it, so we call it bungalow. One has to call something. So the job was a bungalow and we still owe for it, so we call it a bungalow. One has to call. So we go on labeling things. And then we think we know. What do you exactly know? If you drop those names that have become accumulated in your mind, what is left? Nothing exactly. And that nothing has to be realized. Because unless you recognize that nothingness, you will never move into the right direction. The right direction is knowing, not knowledge. What your experts go on doing? I have heard about a doctor. He had just started his practice and the first patient came. He examined the patient but could not get hold of what kind of illness he is suffering from. But he didn't want to show that he does not know. So he looked into the books but he still could not find. He became very nervous. And the patient was sitting on the bed and watching and he started perspiring. Then suddenly an idea came to him. He asked the patient, have you ever suffered from this illness before? The man said, yes. 5 years before, I had suffered from it. And the doctor laughed and he said, so one thing is certain, you have it again. At least he could say something now. He was at ease. You have it again. But even if you can find a name for it, that doesn't mean much. I really was worried about my son Timothy, confessed Mistress Malone to her bridge cronies. He had gotten into the habit of tucking all sorts of things into his pockets, $20 bills off my dressing table, other people's silver spoons, things like that. Then my husband suggested that I take the boy to see Dr. Thingma Bob, who studied analysis with Freud in Vienna. And do you know, girls, my husband was absolutely right. That doctor solved my Timothy's problem after talking to him for just 1 hour. He told me, Mistress Malone, your son is a thief. Now what you are doing? But it seems as if the problem is solved. It appears by naming, by labeling, as if you have solved the problem. Avoid this habit. This is one of the dangerous habits of man. And because of this habit, it has become impossible to penetrate into reality. This habit has become so unconscious, so deep-rooted, so mechanical. The moment you see something, you immediately verbalize. You see the tree and immediately inside you repeat, this is a tree, Gulmohar tree, or a pine tree. This is rose, this is marigold. You continuously go on saying something inside whenever you are facing, encountering anything. And if sometimes you come across something which you don't know the name, you feel a little uneasy. You start inquiring what this thing is called. Once somebody has given you a name, any name will do. You are at ease. How you come to at ease so easily? Just by naming, you think you have known. A child is born and you give a name to the child. And the moment you give the name, you have put a barrier. Now the child will be equivalent to the name. And the name is an invention. And the child was a mystery. And the name is very poor. No name can cover any person. Because each person is such a mystery. What name can cover a person? It is impossible. I know it is needed. The name is needed for utilitarian purposes. But remember well, the rose, the name rose is not the rose. Use the name, but don't forget that the rose is a tremendous existence. Tennyson has said, if I can understand a flower, root and all, then I would have understood the whole existence. Yes, a small rose flower is so vast that if you can understand one small rose flower, you would have understood the whole existence, because everything is so interconnected. If you want to understand the rose flower, you will have to understand the earth. It comes out of it. The earth is the source. And you will have to understand the sky, because it flowers into the sky. You will have to understand the sun, because without the sun it cannot exist. The color comes from the sun. And if you go deep into it, you will find that you will have to understand everything that exists in existence. Only then your knowing about this rose will be complete and total. But just calling it rose, you start thinking you have known. These names give you knowledge, and these names simply confuse you. Ask Joyce, the inquiring child, Dad, is today Wednesday? Answered the patient father, no daughter, today is Thursday. Joyce, But you said yesterday that today is Wednesday. Father, well, today was Wednesday yesterday. Yesterday, Thursday was tomorrow, today. When today is tomorrow, today will be yesterday. Today is today now. Now do you understand? Games of words. Games and nothing else. All your philosophy and all your theology is nothing but games with words, playing with words. And one can play endlessly. One word can lead to another, and so on and so forth. Existence is, and existence is not a word. Existence is, and existence is not a philosophy. Existence is, and existence is not a dogma, theory, scripture. If you want to move into existence, then you have to drop all words, all verbalizing habits. You have to drop language. Language is the barrier. Once language disappears, who you are? Are you a knower then? Then you are not a knower. Then do you know anything? You don't know. You are not a knower and you don't know anything. And exactly in that moment of emptiness, knowing arises. That's what Zen people call Satori. If language is dropped, Satori happens. And the whole effort on the path of Zen, how to drop language. They give paradoxes to solve which cannot be solved. Solving those paradoxes, one by and by gets fed up with language itself. One moment comes, out of sheer exhaustion, language drops and consciousness is freed. Satori has happened. Zen masters say to their disciples, go and meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. Now, one hand cannot clap. To clap, at least two hands are needed. One hand cannot create any sound. For sound to be created, something needs to be placed. Sound is out of conflict. Class. One hand cannot create sound. Now this is absurd. But the disciple has to meditate over it. He meditates. Sometimes it takes 1 year, sometimes 2 years, and sometimes 20 years. It depends. And the disciple goes on meditating morning, afternoon, evening, night. Hardly he sleeps for 5 hours. And again, by the 3 o'clock in the morning, he is sitting again at that absurd game, thinking, meditating, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And he knows well. And his mind says, what nonsense you are doing. This is not possible. You will never find it. But the master says, you have to find it. And he has to go every day to the master to report whether he has found it or not. And the master insults. And sometimes he hits him. And sometimes he throws him out of the room. And he says, you have not found it. You are just a fool. Try harsh. Try more harsh. And he tries hard and hard. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 20 years. What will happen? One goes on becoming tense and tense and tense, and there is no possibility to solve it. So tension cannot be relaxed. That's the secret of koan. If there is some answer, then the tension can be relaxed. But there is no answer. Answer as such is not possible. It has been prohibited from the very beginning. A koan is a puzzle which cannot be solved. If it can be solved, it is not a koan. If the mind can solve it, then the mind can continue. But the mind cannot solve it. The mind is proved again and again impotent, again and again impotent, again and again frustration, again and again the mind feels, I cannot do anything. And this tension goes on and becomes a climax. Thunderous, roaring, like a storm, a madness arises out of it. And the disciple goes on thinking, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And he goes on asking the mind. First, the mind tries to supply answers, linguistic, verbal, borrowed, and the master goes on denying. Even if the disciple does not say anything to the master, he enters in the room and the master says, no, this is not the answer. Because in fact there is no answer. So the master knows no answer can be brought. Then one day, out of sheer exhaustion, out of sheer tiredness, total tiredness, the mind flops. Language disappears. And with language disappearing, with mind disappearing, the question disappears. Who is there to ask? And if there is no language, how can you formulate the question? What is the sound of one hand clapping? With the mind dropping, the question disappears. There is tremendous peace, silence, a state of no language. Sometimes the disciple may not go. Who bothers to go to the master now? But then the master comes. Or sometimes the disciple may go. And even before he has said anything, and the master will say, so you have come home? So you have arrived. So you have crossed the barrier of language. So you have become silent. From that silence, knowing grows. All that you know, all that you think as knowledge is rubbish. Know it as rubbish and drop it. All that is borrowed, all that is learned from others, and all that you know is learned from others. Has to be dropped. It is humiliating. To carry it and to declare that it is knowledge is humiliating. Two comics met in Lindy's. One of them was furious. I saw you at the palace, he roared. You told every joke I told on my broadcast. They were my jokes. Look, wise guy, answered the accused. Anything that comes out of my radio is mine. I have paid for it, have not I? Anything that comes out of my radio is mine. I have paid for it. Anything that comes out of your Bible is yours because you have purchased the Bible. Anything that comes out of the Quran is yours because you are a Mohammedan. Anything that comes out of Vedas is yours because accidentally you were born into a Hindu family. All that you know, pile it and burn it forever. It will be difficult because your whole ego is involved in it. To recognize the fact that I don't know is the most difficult thing a man can do. But in fact, a very manly thing. When you do it, you have become for the first time a real man. Before it, you were just pseudo, phony. And this knowledge gives you a false sense of knowing, but it never transforms your life. It never really gives anything to you. You know what is good, but you do what is not good. You know anger is bad, but you go on being angry. You know, but what is the use of this knowledge? It never becomes in any way part of your being. And it cannot become. Many people come to me and they say, we know. We know exactly what is right and what is wrong, but we are weak. And we cannot do the right, and we go on becoming victims of the wrong. That is not the right thing. They are not weak. Nobody is weak. God never creates weaklings. It is impossible. Then from where arises the problem? The problem arises because knowledge is not a transforming force. So you know, but it never transforms you. So it gives you a feeling that you are weak. It makes you feel impotent. Look at it. Your knowledge, rather than helping you, destroys your self-confidence. It is better to be angry and not to know that anger is bad. But to know that anger is bad and then be angry is very dangerous. You are getting split. A part of your mind goes on saying it is wrong, and a part of your mind goes on doing it all the same. You are becoming schizophrenic. Your knowledge makes you schizophrenic. Knowledge is important. Hence, it makes you feel important. Drop out of the company of knowledge. And then, if you know really that anger is bad, out of your own experience, that very knowing transforms. Then you will never be angry again. How you can be? Once you know fire burns, how you can put your hand into it? It is impossible. Unless you want to burn your hand, then it is totally different. When you know you cannot get out of the wall and you will get hurt in the head, you don't try. Unless you want to break your head. Knowing is always in tune with your being. Knowledge is always out of tune. The police chief was angry. Now you have been on the force for 2 years and never made an arrest, he shouted at patrolman Pat. I'm gonna give you one more chance. Someone is stealing Squire Davis apples. Go up there and catch the thief. So Pat goes up there, and around midnight he pounces on a masked man in the orchard, trying to sneak away with a pack on his back. He opens the bag and finds it contains valuable silver. So he returns it to the masked man. Sorry, my mistake, Pat says. But you can thank your stars, it was not apples. That's how it is happening. Knowledge never gives you insight. It makes you rather blind. Knowledge is blinding. Knowing is an insight, a clarity, a transparency. Knowledge is old, knowing is always fresh, young. It arises out of the now. Knowledge is very ancient. Religions go on establishing their oldness. Hindus say that they are the oldest religion in the world. So say the Jews, So say the Jainas, ancient most. Why? Why? This constant effort to prove that we are the oldest, because knowledge is valuable if it is old. Knowledge is like wine. The older it is, the more valuable. And knowledge is intoxicating. Yes, it is like wine. It is a drug. It dulls you. It makes you insensitive. It makes you unconscious. Knowing is fresh. A man of knowing arrives to his knowing each moment again and again. He never carries the old. He lives in the moment. He is responsive, sensitive, alert, aware. A French portrait painter sat in his favorite cafe, sipping his wine. His first small bottle finished, he was about to order a second when his eyes fell on a headline of a paper, "Hard times coming." So instead of ordering his usual second bottle, he called for his check. "Is there anything wrong with the wine?" asked the landlord. "The wine is good, but I didn't order a second bottle because hard times are coming and we must economize," explained the artist. "Hard times," said the landlord. "Then my wife must not order that silk dress we planned, but must take one of cotton." "Hard times?" repeated the dressmaker when the order was cancelled. "This is no time to expend. I must not make the improvement I had planned in this place." "Hard times? Ah," said the builder. "When the dressmaker cancelled the plans, then I cannot have my wife's portrait painted." So he wrote the artist and cancelled the order. After receiving the letter, the artist went again to his favorite cafe and ordered a small bottle of wine to soothe him. On a nearby chair was the paper in which he had read of hard times a few days before. He picked it up to read more closely and found that it was 10 years old. But knowledge circulates. It goes on from one hand to another, and it affects people tremendously. They start living, at least they try to live out of it. It cripples them. You all have become cripples. You are not centered because your knowledge has forced you out of your centering. A child is centered. The moment he starts growing and he starts knowing things, he becomes more and more decentered, goes astray. An old man completely forgets where his center is. This parable, and I call it a parable, it is metaphorical. Try to understand it. It is of great beauty. Charles Xiang Tzu went hunting in the central mountains with a party of 100,000. He set fire to the forest by lighting the tall grass and fanned the flames for 100 miles. A man came out from within a stone cliff, rising and falling with the smoke and ashes. The crowd thought he was a demon. When the fire passed, he came out walking casually as though the fire he had passed through did not exist. Chao Xiang Tzu marveled and detained the man. He scrutinized him at leisure. In his shape, his color, and the 7 holes in his head, he was a human. In his breathing, in his voice, he was human. He asked the man by what way he lived in a stone and went through fire. What are these things you call a stone and fire? Said the man. The thing you have just come out from was a stone. The thing you have just been walking through was fire. I did not know, said the man. Marcus Wang of Wei heard of it and questioned Tazusia, a very well-known learned man. What sort of man was that? According to what I have heard my master say, the man who is in harmony is absolutely the same as other things, and nothing succeeds in wounding or obstructing him. To pass through metal and stone and tread through water and fire are all possible. Why don't you do it yourself? Said Marcus Wayne. I am not yet capable of cutting open my heart and throwing away the knowledge in it. However, I can tell you all you want to know about it. Why doesn't your master do it? Asked the Marquis. My master is one who, though able to do it, is able not to do it. Marquis Wen was delighted with the answer. Now, go slowly into this parable step by step. First, a man came out from within a stone cliff, rising and falling with the smoke and ashes. This is a Taoist attitude, that if you move flow with life without any resistance, without any effort, without any direction of your own, if you follow life wherever it leads, like a dry leaf in the wind. The wind goes to the south and the leaf also goes to the south. The wind takes the leaf up and the leaf goes into the clouds. And the wind drops it back and the leaf sleeps silently under the tree on the earth. The leaf has no desire and the leaf has no direction of its own. The leaf has no ego. Desire and direction are byproducts of the ego. You want to be somebody, you want to reach somewhere, you want to prove something, you want to do something, you want to swim against the current, then you are not a man of Tao. You don't swim at all. There is no question of going against the current, but just going with the river wherever it leads. Not pushing, not pulling, not trying to manipulate life, but just rising and falling with it. Then you are dissolved. Then how anything can harm you? Have you watched it? Taoists go again and again telling these stories. You may have watched many times it happening. A drunkard falls on the road but is not hurt. You fall and you break few bones. What happens? Why the drunkard has not been wounded by the road? And he falls every night. And every night he has to be brought home. Somebody carries him. And again in the morning he is going to the office, smiling and happy. I used to live with a drunkard. He was just my neighbor for a few years. A very beautiful man. And sometimes his wife will come to me and she will say, my husband has not returned. He may be lying somewhere in the gutter. And it is dark. And I cannot go. Will not you help me a little? Can't you go and find him? And I will go and find him. Many times I will go and find him lying down in some gutter or on some road or just leaning against a post. And I will bring him. But he was never hurt. And in the morning, he was as fresh as ever, again rushing to the office, and in the evening, again the same story. Watching him, one thing became absolutely certain: Taoists are right. Because when he falls, he is unself-conscious. When he falls, he simply falls. He is not resisting. When you fall, you don't simply fall. You try to protect. You become harsh. You resist. In that very resistance is danger. When you are hard, your bones are bound to break. Not because the earth is going to hurt you. Your own resistance hurts you. Out of this Taoist attitude have arisen many arts in the Far East. Aikido, Jiu-Jitsu, and others. The approach is to be relaxed. Even if the enemy hurts you, you absorb it rather than fighting with it. And you will not be hurt. Difficult, a great art to persuade yourself not to become hard when somebody is striking you is difficult, because we have been trained for centuries to protect, to fight, to struggle, to make effort to survive. Taoist attitude is to go with life, to go all the way, to go without any conditions. Wherever it leads, go with it. Trust life so tremendously that you don't fear, that you don't have any fear from life. You come from life, you are part of life, so how there is any possibility that life will harm you? There is no need to be fear, to be afraid, to have fear. Rising and falling with the smoke and ashes, the man came out of the stone cliff, walked through fire. The crowd thought he was a demon. When the fire passed, he came out walking casually, as though the fire he had passed through did not exist. Looks like a miracle. But this miracle can happen to you. I am not saying go and walk through fire. That is just a parable, a beautiful story to say something of great significance. Try it in your life. Become unself-conscious. Don't carry this self and a constant struggle with life. Sometimes relax. Sometimes let things be. And see what happens. And you will be surprised. Once you let things be, once you start living in a let-go, or living as let-go, then you will see the life is not enemy to you. It is tremendously friendly. It has to be. It is your mother. It is your father. It is your source. And it is your goal. You come out of it and one day you will disappear in it. Why fear? Out of fear comes fight. Out of fight, you become a separate individual. Naturally, when you become a separate individual, you are in trouble. Then this vast existence you take as the enemy. That is the Western approach. The whole nature is your enemy. It has to be conquered. Conquest of nature. That's what science has been doing for 2-3 centuries. And it has destroyed all beauty of life. It has polluted the whole atmosphere, the whole ecology of the earth is disturbed because of these people who have been trying to conquer. It is foolish. It is as if my one hand tries to conquer my whole body. It is as foolish as that. Man trying to conquer earth, man trying to conquer the sky, man trying to conquer nature is just absurd. And once you try to conquer nature, naturally, one day or other, you will try to conquer your innermost nature also. That is a corollary to it, a natural corollary to it. First you try to conquer the outer nature, then you start trying to conquer the inner nature. But then you are always in conflict, friction. You become a very sharp ego. And of course, tremendously miserable, terribly miserable, infinitely miserable. Misery is to fall out of step with existence. Happiness is to fall in step with existence. And to fall in step with existence is so simple because it is so natural. Rising and falling with the smoke, the man walked out casually as though the fire he had passed through did not exist. In his shape, his color, and the seven holes in his head, he was human. In his breathing, in his voice, he was human. He asked the man by what way he lived in stone and went through fire. Of course, Chao Xiang Tzu was very much surprised, intrigued by the phenomenon. He could not believe his own eyes. How this man can be human? We have lost all meaning of real humanity. This man looked like a demon. Something not of the human. Either something evil or something godly, but not human. Then Chao Xiang Tzu looked at the man. In his shape, his color, and the seven holes in his head, he was human. In his breathing, in his voice, human, he was human. Remember, in a human is the abode of the superhuman. Man is not an end. Man has infinite possibilities. Man is very potential. Man is not only the past, but the future also. Man has an infinite destiny in front of him. He has to grow. And he can grow to superhuman heights. But the growth comes not out of effort. The growth comes in cooperation with nature. The growth comes through harmony, through harmonious cooperation. The growth comes not as a conquest, but as a surrender. That's the difference between other religions and the Taoists. The other religions emphasize too much about the will. And Taoists say, will is really the calamity, surrender. One should become as will-less as possible. The moment you are will-less, then there is no problem. All blocks removed, and deep inside you, the superhuman rises to its optimum height. Yes, he looked like man. Buddha also looked like man. So looked Lao Tzu. So looked Krishna. So looked Christ. They were all men, but still, something of the beyond had penetrated them. Because of that beyond, we have given different names. Jesus is called Christ, the only begotten Son of God. These are just metaphorical ways of saying one thing, and only one thing, that something of the beyond has happened into Jesus. He is no more just the son of Joseph and Maryam. Something of the beyond, something of the infinite has entered into his being. He is the son of God. Hindus call Krishna avatar. Avatar means God has descended. God has come to the earth. Names differ. Metaphors differ. But one thing is certain, that whenever some human being has really fallen in tune with nature, something so superb happens in his life that we cannot just call him a man. We have to call him a new name to indicate that he has gone beyond humanity. But remember, he has gone beyond humanity because it is human to go beyond humanity. It is part of human to go beyond humanity. And unless you have gone beyond, you have not fulfilled your destiny. Then you are not really human. Then you are just a man. That's the difference I make between man and human. Man is a status. Human is a process. Man is a static concept. Human is a growth concept, a growing concept, a movement. A human being is one who is constantly changing into superhuman, and a man is one who has become dormant, is not moving anywhere, is simply drying and dying. Start moving. Man is like frozen ice. Human is like a river flowing. The ice has melted. And when the river flows, it is bound to reach to the ocean. The river is meant to reach to the ocean. It will reach. And there is no need for any map. The rivers don't carry any map. There is no need even for a guide. There are no needs for milestones. The river simply flows, not knowing where it is going, and one day it arrives. So happens to the consciousness, the stream of consciousness. Just float naturally, in a relaxed way, not in a hurry, not in impatience, cool, collected, in deep cooperation with nature, flow, and one day you will arrive. Just by allowing the flow to happen, you reach. Chao Siang Tzu asked the man by what way he lived in a stone and went through fire. That's natural. We always ask by what way, how you achieved, the method, the technology. Buddha is asked again and again by what way you have achieved. And Buddha says, the moment you ask this question, you created trouble for me, because I achieved it only when I dropped all the ways, the pathless path. When I was on the way, I could not achieve it. For 6 years, I was struggling hard. I was doing the utmost that I can do. And I failed utterly. Then one day, there was nothing left to be done. I had done all that can be done humanly. Nothing to do, I relaxed. And that very moment I attained. So when you ask me by what way, you created trouble for me, because I attained it only when I had dropped all the ways. And that is one of the greatest insights ever. And that is the very fundamental of the Taoist approach towards life. Never ask by what way. If you ask, you ask a wrong question. And there is a possibility that some foolish person may answer. Fools are all around. If you ask a foolish question, you are bound to to get a fullest answer. Once a question is asked, you will get an answer. People are very much ready to supply advices and answers. But if the question is wrong, the answer is bound to be wrong. Because only a wrong answer can fit with the wrong question. If you ask a wrong question and I supply you a right answer, you will think I'm irrelevant. You had asked something else and I'm talking about something else. This happens again and again. In darshan, I watch people. If they ask a wrong question and I give them a right answer, they look a little puzzled. They look uneasy. They feel as if they had asked something else and I have answered something else. It does not fit. It is not an answer to their question, and they are right too. It is not an answer to their question. Because their question was so wrong, only a wrong answer can fit with it. Remember not to ask a wrong question. Otherwise, there are priests and there are pandits and they will supply you answers. They have been cheating humanity. Because humanity, out of foolishness, asks wrong questions. Then they supply wrong answers, and those wrong answers fit perfectly well with your wrong questions, and then they cheat you. I have heard in a country village there was a laborer who killed his hog, and it was the custom in such cases to send pieces of meat, sausages, black puddings and liver to all the neighbors. This farmer, who had already received innumerable presents of this kind, found if he adhered to this custom, he should have nothing left for himself. Confiding in one of his neighbors, he said, "I have killed my hog, and if I should send a piece to all from whom I have received, there will be none left for myself. Now, I pray you, advise me what is best to be done." To which his neighbor replied, "If I were in your case, I could hang up my hog at my open window for the greater part of the night, and the next day I would tell everybody it was stolen. By this means, I should be excused from making presents." The laborer, much pleased with his friend's advice, returned home and put it in practice. The giver of this friendly advice, not failing to profit by the darkness of the night, seized the hog and carried it home. How astonished was the farmer when early in the morning he found nothing of his hog. He raved at his neighbor's invention, which he had the evening before so much approved of. He sallied out to give the alarm, and the first he met was his friendly adviser, to whom he related the whole affair, saying, "Ah, neighbor, what do you think? They have stolen my hog." There, says his neighbor, "That's right, stand to it. Tell the same story to everybody you meet, and I have no doubt they will all believe you." The farmer began to swear and to protest most solemnly that it was no joke, that his hog was absolutely gone. But the stronger he was in his expressions of grief and vexation, the more his neighbor exclaimed, That's right, my friend. Stand to it well, and they will all excuse your presence." The priests have been exploiting humanity because man, out of his stupidity, has been asking wrong questions. Of course, you get wrong answers, and you have to pay for those wrong answers. They don't come cheap. They don't come free. you have to pay costly for them. This man, Chao Xiang Tzu, asks, by what way? The question seems logical, relevant, meaningful. It is not. Because a way means a will. You know the proverb, wherever there is a will, there is a way. Let me say to you, wherever there is a way, there is a will. The way comes out of the will. The way is nothing but will translated practically into life. Tao has no way because Tao has no will. Will means struggle. Will means fight. All ways are ways of struggle. Tao is a pathless path. No way. Things are good as they are. There is nowhere to go. So what is the point of any way? One has simply to relax and be here now. And remember, relaxation is not a way that you have to follow. If you make it a way, it will not be a relaxation. There will come will. I have read one book, of course, American. The title of the book, You Must Relax. Now, must is very much American and naturally very much tense. You must relax. Even relaxation has to be a must. Then how you will relax? It is something to do and you have to do. It is almost like a commandment. You have to follow the commandment. If you don't relax, it will look almost as if you are committing a sin. You must relax. And what you will do when you will be relaxing? You will do something. And whatsoever you do will be wrong. Because relaxation comes only when you are not doing anything at all. If you are doing something, counting sheep, or just going from 1 to 100 and then coming back from 199, 98 back to 1. Whatever you are doing, are just trying to relax the whole body. Relax the legs and then relax your stomach and relax the hands. But you are doing it. All doing is a tension. Relaxation is not something that you have to do. When you don't do anything, it is there. When you are not doing, it is there. It is in your non-doing. If you do something, that will be your undoing. This is absolutely wrong to say to somebody, you must relax. It is almost as if you go to an insane person, you say, you must be sane. Now what he will do? He is insane. He can make great efforts to become sane. He will become more insane. He is insane because he is tense. Now you are giving him another goal to become tense more, even more. There is no way. Tao says, drop all ways. All ways are mind inventions. All ways are man fabricated. Tao is when there is no way, no will, when you are not going anywhere, no goal to achieve, nothing to become, nowhere to arrive. Then what you will do? You will simply plop. You will relax into existence. In that very moment, you have crossed humanity. You have become superhuman. He asked the man by what way he lived in stone and went through fire. What are these things you call stone and fire? Said the man. That is innocence. He does not know what is stone and what is fire. He must be a very childlike man. This is the idea, the Taoist idea, that a man should be so innocent, the cloud of unknowing. What are these things you call stone and fire? Said the man. The thing you have just come out from was a stone. The thing you have just been walking through was fire. I did not know, said the man. In his not knowing is his knowing. Because he was in a state of not knowing, there was no barrier. How can fire burn you if you don't know that it is fire and that it burns? Now this has to be understood. If you want to understand it exactly, you will have to ask the hypnotist. You can ask our Santos what exactly it means. In deep hypnosis, he can someday do an experiment before you. In deep hypnosis, you put an ordinary pebble on the hand of the hypnotized person and you tell the person who is deeply in unconsciousness that this is a burning coal, burning heart, and you will be burnt. And it is just an ordinary pebble, cold. And you put the pebble on the hand and the man will be burnt. And his hand will show that there has been a burning coal on it. What happens? And you can do the other wise also. You can put a burning coal into his hand and you can say it is just a cold stone. And he will not be burnt. Now, these are now proved scientific facts. What happens exactly when you put a burning coal on the hand of the man? Why is he not being burnt? If fire burns, then he should be burnt. What does it matter whether he is conscious or unconscious, hypnotized or not hypnotized? What does it matter if you say it is a cold stone? By your saying, how things change? Hypnosis is a very revealing force. It has been condemned too much in the West, particularly because of wrong attitudes of Christianity. Otherwise, hypnosis is a door to inner reality. And it has to become a door in the coming days. By and by, more and more people are getting interested into it, and more scientific research work is being done. And it reveals tremendous phenomenon. One of the phenomenon which is relevant to this parable is that you create your reality by believing in it. This is a tremendous discovery. You create your reality by believing in it. The reality is as you believe it. Your belief becomes your reality. If your belief changes, your reality changes. Man lives in a very unreal reality. That is the meaning of the Hindu word Maya. Maya means magic. Maya means that which appears but is not. We live in Maya. We live in a very illusory world. We create our own world. You can go to deep forests in India where primitive societies still live. They have their belief systems. You will be surprised. They work. Somebody can kill a person far away, miles far away, by doing a certain ritual. If he wants to kill somebody who does not belong to the primitive society, he will not be able. But he can kill anybody who belongs to their society, because their belief system is the same. Once the person comes to know that a certain ritual has been done which has always killed people, he will immediately die. He will simply relapse into death. In America, in 1952, they had made a small law, Anti-Hypnotic Act. Because in a certain university, few students were doing some experiments, just curious. Four students were doing an experiment in their room. One was lying on the bed and three were hypnotizing him. And the boy who was being hypnotized must have been of a tremendous capacity, must have been a mediumistic person. He fell into real deep hypnosis, which rarely happens. Ordinarily, 33% people are hypnotizable. And out of those 33%, not more than 3% are deeply hypnotizable. So out of 100 persons, only 3 are really deep hypnotic subjects, which can go in deep trance. Otherwise, others go in a trance, but they remain just on the periphery. They will do something which they agree to do. If you say to do something which they don't agree, they will immediately come out of their hypnosis. But that boy must have been out of those 3% rare people. And the three were hypnotizing him and they were playing just like a joke. They have read a book and they were trying. It was just coincidence that the boy was very hypnotizable, suggestible. And they said many things and he did many things. And then suddenly the idea came to one and they said to him, "Now you are dead." And the boy died. Then they tried to bring him back, but once a person is gone, one is gone. Then hypnosis cannot work. Hypnosis reveals one thing, that if you believe into something very deeply, it starts functioning on your mind, on your being. It becomes reality. Reality is not always real. Ordinarily, whatsoever you think is real is 90% imaginary. But it works as reality. Buddha has defined reality as that which works. And that definition is really meaningful. Whatsoever works is real. If somebody in a deep hypnotic trance is burnt because you put a cold stone in his hand, then it is fire for him. It works. And he will carry the wound for many days. The body believed it. The consciousness believed it. Then it functioned. The man said, "I did not know." You must have heard about fire walkers. They walk because of a great trust. They believe that the fire is not going to burn. They move in a deep hypnotic trance. In India, there are many fire walkers. In Ceylon, the best group of fire walkers, Buddhist monks. Every year, once a year, they gather around the temple of Kendi and they walk on fire. The belief is Buddha protects. and certainly the brief works. Not that Buddha protects, but if you think Buddha protects, then the belief works. Your belief protects. It happened once, a Christian missionary went to see it, and of course, it was a challenge to him. Buddhist monks walking on fire and Buddha protecting, somebody challenged him and somebody said, "You believe in Christ, what about you? Why don't you walk?" Now the challenge was such he could not say no. And he was a missionary and he was teaching to people that Buddha is nothing, Christ is all. So they said, "Then now, let us see what happens." He may not have been burnt if he had really believed, but no missionary ever believes. He became suspicious. He was afraid. He walked out of the ego, not out of the trust. He walked seeing that if these 30 people are not burnt, why I should be? Not only that, he remembered Christ, he even remembered Buddha too inside. That it is okay, protect me too, if you are protecting these 30 people. But it was a doubtful mind. He was burnt, terribly burnt. The same group was invited to Oxford in 1960, and they walked there. And thousands of people watched. And a professor of philosophy, a simple man, just looking at this whole phenomenon, became so enchanted that without saying anything to anybody, he jumped into the fire and he walked. And he was not burnt. What happened? Neither Buddha nor Christ. Simply seeing that if 30 human beings can walk, then why not I am also a human being? It is humanly possible. The very idea that it is humanly possible became a trust. There was no doubt in it. He jumped without hesitation and he could walk. I am not saying that you should go and walk on fire. But watch your life and you will see. Many things happen only because you believe. Many things cannot happen to you because you disbelieve. Many things are not possible because there is doubt. Many things become possible because there is trust. You create your reality. Look at the splendor of human consciousness. You create your reality. You are the center of your world. You create your world. You hold your world. If you are miserable, remember it is you who are creating it. If you are happy, know well it is you who are creating it. It is your world. You can create a happy world, you can create an unhappy world. The hell is your habit of creating unhappy worlds around you. Heaven is another habit of creating happy worlds around you. And nirvana is to know that all that mind creates is useless. Why not move into that which is uncreated by mind? That is the ultimate. Then there is no misery and no happiness, no good, no bad, no heaven, no hell. I did not know, said the man. He walked into fire but was not burnt. Fire burns only because the idea is in you that it burns. The idea burns really, not the fire. You can watch it in small things. When Western people come to India, they start suffering from many diseases. dysentery, diarrhea, hepatitis. They are very much afraid about the unhygienic conditions here. The water is not clean, not scientifically clean. But Indians have lived on that water for centuries, and there has never been any problem. But when you come with the idea that the water is unhygienic and you drink it, you are drinking your idea. It is dangerous, more dangerous than the unhygienic water. The water may be unhygienic, but it is not so dangerous as the idea that you are drinking with it. It is unhygienic. Now you are taking a dangerous step. It is a suggestion. Each time you drink water, the suggestion goes in. You are creating an auto-hypnosis. How long you will be able to stand? You will fall. You will have hepatitis. And when you have hepatitis, of course, your old idea is strengthened even more, that I was right. The water was not hygienic. No Indian suffers. You should go to Indian villages. In the same small pond, the buffaloes, the bullocks, the cows are enjoying, doing their thing. And man is also doing his thing. And everything goes on. And nobody is worried. Nobody has any idea. Everything is good. If you go to a Hindu sacred place, you will not find any idea, any concept of hygiene. And people think that is a sacred place and the water is holy. And you will not even be able to get into that water. And they are enjoying. They have waited for their whole lives to come to this holy water and to take a dip. And they are drinking. And they will carry the water in bottles and flasks to their home. It is holy water. And if you take it to the scientist, he will say it is the unholiest. Throw it away, don't bring it here. Never touch it and never go close to it. What is happening? An idea becomes a reality. I was for a few months once in a primitive community in Bastar. The women go to the field, they work there, are in the forest, and suddenly they have a birth, and they give birth to a child, nobody to look after them, no hospitalization, no nurses, no doctors, no human being. The woman may be alone in the field working. She will keep the child under the tree and start working again. No pain, nothing whatsoever. They have not heard about the pain that every civilized woman suffers from. Because they have not heard, so they don't suffer. Civilized women suffer very much. The more civilized a country, the more. In fact, a Western woman thinks continuously for 9 months now. The day is coming, the day is coming, the doomsday is coming. And she goes on hypnotizing and hypnotizing and hypnotizing. Of course, then it comes. You create 9 months is a long hypnosis. And by, the energy builds up. And then the pain, then the tremendous pain. You may not have heard, in Amazon, there exists a tribe in which not only the woman suffers from the birth pain, even the husband suffers. Husband, you will say, yes. For centuries in that tribe, the idea has remained prevalent. And it seems very logical too, and very socialistic. I think the live women will agree to it. Why should only women suffer? Why not there should be equality? So when a child is born, the woman lies on one cart and another cart lies the husband. And they both suffer. And of course, when a man suffers, he suffers more. He is more vigorous and screams more and shouts more and swears more. He defeats the woman. And you will think that he is simply pretending, then you are wrong. He is not pretending. It really happens. Doctors have gone there and they have watched and they have examined the bodies. Really cramps and pain in the body. It really happens. Because for centuries they have been living with the idea that the child belongs to both. So naturally, both have to suffer. Now when people started reaching to that tribe and telling them, then this is foolish. Because in our societies, husbands have never suffered. They could not believe. They said, how it can be possible? It cannot be. It looked absurd to them as it looks absurd to us. If you go to Bastar and you tell that our women suffer very much, they laugh. They say, this is foolish. There is no pain at all. Now, in few Western countries, particularly France, painless worth is being rediscovered. Few doctors are working. And thousands of children have been given birth without any pain. But again, the hypnosis, the idea has to be put deep down into the woman that there is going to be no pain. Once the idea settles there, there is no pain. You live in your self-created world. Marcus Vane of Wey heard of it and questioned Tazusia, a well-known, very well-known learned man. What sort of man was that? According to what I have heard my master say, the man who is in harmony is absolutely the same as other things, and nothing succeeds in wounding or obstructing him. This man, Tazusia, is a scholar, a pandit. He has heard. He says, I have heard my master say that when a man is in deep harmony with nature, nothing obstructs, nothing harms, nothing wounds him. Harmony is protection. To pass through metal and stone and tread through water and fire are all possible. Why don't you do it yourself? Said the Marquis. Naturally, when you know, why don't you do it yourself? I am not yet capable of cutting open my heart and throwing away the knowledge in it. That's the only barrier. The man was a pandit, but must have been a sincere and honest man. He didn't defend his knowledge. He accepted his ignorance. He said, I am not a man of knowing, just a man of knowledge. I have heard people say, I have been close to people who know, but I don't know myself. I only know about these things. However, I can tell you all you want to know about it, but I don't know exactly what it is. About it, I know. I have all the information possible. I have gathered all the information. But as far as I am concerned, I have not yet been able to throw away the knowledge in my heart. Hence, I am not in harmony. Knowledge is disharmony with existence. To know is to miss knowing. To be burdened with knowledge is to be far away from reality. I am not yet capable of cutting open my heart. The other day somebody had asked, why my heart is empty? The heart is empty because your head is too full. Make the head empty, your heart will become full. It is the same energy. If it gets involved into head, the heart remains empty. If it is not involved into the head, it falls into the heart. And only when your heart is full, you are full. Only when your heart is full, you flower, you bloom. Why does not your master do it? Asked the Marquis. My master is one who, though able to do it, is able not to do it. That is the pinnacle of a miraculous man. To do a miracle is great, but not great enough. To do a miracle is still to be in the world of the ego. The very idea of doing it means you are still separate from reality. A real greatness is so ordinary that it claims nothing. It is so ordinary that it never tries to prove anything. My master is one who, though able to do it, is able not to do it. This is the Taoist concept of the real masters. Real masters have never done miracles. In the West, Christians go on trying to prove that Jesus did miracles. If you ask Taoists, Buddhists, they will laugh. They will say, these people are insulting Jesus. If it is true that he did miracles, that simply proves then he was not the real master. Buddha never did any miracles. But then, are they simply fantasizing, creating lies around Jesus? No. Sometimes miracles happen around a master, but he never does it. That is possible. Miracles may have happened around Jesus, that is possible. But he has not done them. And he goes on repeating again and again. A woman came, she touched the garment of Jesus, and she was healed. And he looked back, and the woman was very thankful. And he said, I am very grateful, you healed me. And he said, don't say such a thing. Your faith has healed you. He is tremendously true. It is not the garment of Jesus that has healed. It is your faith. It is not Jesus that he has done anything. It is your own faith that has done something to you. No, in the East we have never claimed. And if somebody claims in the East that he is doing miracles, that simply shows that the East is losing its easternness, its great heights. It is coming to the marketplace, to the very ordinary, to the business-like world, where claims are significant. No, my master is one who, though able to do it, is able not to do it. Marquis Wen was delighted with the answer. The answer was beautiful. He was delighted. Of course, to be delighted is not to be enlightened. It was just a scholarly answer. A man who himself does not know anything, who knows about, yes, the answer delighted. But if it had come from a man of knowing, it would have made him enlightened. Delight is just entertainment. Good to listen to great truths, but nothing of value. Just listening to great truths is of not much value unless you listen so tremendously, so totally, that it becomes a transformation, that you become enlightened through it. It depends on two things. First, there should be a man who has himself known through experience. Then there should be somebody who is ready to receive it with open heart. Wherever this rare opportunity arises, that a man is there who knows, who really knows, not through knowledge but through his experience, and there is a disciple, a receiving, open heart. Wherever this rare opportunity arises, there is great lightning, enlightenment. Enough for today.